Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Luke's English Podcast. This is part two of a two-part series in which I explain and describe my holiday, my recent travelling experience in Indonesia. I suggest that if you haven't heard part one yet, that you go back and listen to that before listening to this one, okay? Because it'll make more sense, you'll get more context and so on. So do go back and listen to part one. If you've already done that, let's get started with part two. Where did I leave you? I was just about to explain some more specific things about where we went and what we saw in the beautiful and mysterious country that is Indonesia. So we flew, of course. We didn't walk or take a bicycle or anything. No, we flew. Because Indonesia is so far away, it's very difficult to get a direct flight from Paris. So we flew from Paris to Kuala Lumpur. And then from Kuala Lumpur, we flew to Jakarta. And then from Jakarta, we took a domestic flight to Yogyakarta, which is another city on Java in Indonesia. And that's where we stayed for our first few nights. All in all, it was about 30 hours of traveling. 30 hours of traveling, which is a huge time spent in transit. And it does sort of take its toll on you a bit. Usually in the form of jet lag. And you know jet lag, I'm sure you've experienced it. And it can affect you in mysterious ways. You can feel okay 1 minute, the next minute you feel like you're in a catatonic state and that you can't keep your eyes open. It can be a bit bizarre. Our trick for dealing with jet lag is when you get onto the plane, immediately you have to try and set your watch and set your mental clock, as it were, to the time at your destination. So as early as possible, you've got to try and start getting ready for the time zone in the destination that you're going to. So that meant getting on the plane and immediately switching our watches, 7 hours ahead, so we could then get used to the time difference. And then, you're at a bit more of an advantage when you arrive because you've spent 24 hours kind of getting used to it. That's the theory. It's not perfect because, of course, your body clock is still there, still operating on your previous time. But it does help a little bit. The flight, absolutely fine. And in fact, while I was flying, I did take the chance to record a little bit of a little entry for this episode of Luke's English Podcast, and I think I'd like to play that for you now. So here is my my quick podcast entry from the flight, from the jumbo jet. It must have been kilometers above the surface of the earth, flying through the air. It was a great opportunity to record part of an episode of Luke's English Podcast on a plane. So here we go. I'm going to play that to you right now.
Hello, everyone. This is Luke from Luke's English Podcast, of course. And at the moment, I'm actually in a toilet again. Not for the first time, but I'm not in a toilet on a train. I'm actually in a toilet on a plane. That's right. I don't know how high up in the sky I am, but I'm very high up on board a plane on my way to Indonesia, flying from Paris to Kuala Lumpur. And I couldn't let this opportunity pass, could I? Certainly not. I couldn't let this chance slip through my fingers. I had to record part of an episode in a toilet on a plane. We've been in the air for about 5 hours. The passengers are either sleeping or they're watching in-flight entertainment. The last time I checked, the map, we were flying almost directly over Iraq, somewhere in the region of Baghdad. I'm also flying on a Malaysian Airlines flight. I'm trying not to think about either of those things too much right now. That's it. With my girlfriend, we're going to have our holiday in Indonesia, and from time to time I might record some short entries into this sort of audio diary. Okay, I don't know if it's going to get any better than this. I mean, it's quite rare that I'm in a toilet on a plane on a Malaysian Airlines flight somewhere above war-torn Iraq. I don't know what other situations I'll be in when I'm recording, but anyway, this is Luke from Luke's English Podcasts signing out. Bye for now.
Okay, there's my entry from the toilet on the plane way, way above Iraq on a Malaysian Airlines flight. Right, so Kuala Lumpur, very nice airport. Flying to Jakarta. Now there is a joke. There is a joke, and which I'm going to tell to you, but I don't expect you to get it or even to laugh at it. But I'm going to tell you the joke anyway, because how could I go to Indonesia with my my future wife and not tell this joke? Well, all right. So there's a series of jokes which involve someone saying, "My wife has gone to blah blah blah." Okay. And then a response to that. So it's like, "My wife's gone to blah, blah, blah." So in this case, it's, "My wife's gone to Indonesia." What, Jakarta? No, she went by plane. Right, now that's the joke. And you're probably thinking, what? Well, okay, let me explain. It's not worth very much, but it's a joke that I enjoy. "My wife's gone to Indonesia." Jakarta. Now, Jakarta here, obviously, is the capital of Indonesia. But Jakarta also sounds like someone is saying, "Did you cart her?" Jakarta, did you cart her? A cart is like something you would use in the garden to kind of carry stuff around the garden. You know, it's got a wheel at the front, it's got two handles at the back, and you can use it to carry things around in your garden. It's a cart. You might use a kind of, it's a bit like a trolley, okay? A trolley, a cart. So, "My wife's gone to Indonesia." Jakarta, no, she went by plane. Right, okay, fine. There's other ones. "My wife's gone to the West Indies, the Caribbean." What, Jamaica? No, she chose to go herself. Mm-hmm. Okay. Jamaica, meaning did you make her go? "My wife's gone to the Caribbean." What, Jamaica? No, she went of her own accord. I just know that you're not getting that. I'm just convinced that you're not understanding that. I've got no idea. Normally, in front of an audience, you get, you know, a response. Like, you get laughter, or you get nothing, or you get abuse, or people throw tomatoes at you, or something. You know, that's how you know whether the joke has gone down well or not. I've got absolutely no idea whether that joke has gone down well, but I'm pretty sure that in both cases that it's a probably a failure. There are loads of like jokes based on places. Like, for example, I went to see a band the other day. I went to see a music group the other day. They were from somewhere in Asia. What, Singapore? Yeah, but the drummer was good. Singapore, meaning was the singer poor? I went to see, it's the whole point of that, of these jokes, is that they're very contrived. You see that the setup is like a really contrived way of making a joke. It's a kind of joke about jokes, in a way. Like, in order to really appreciate this, you understand that sometimes jokes are just very sort of contrived, that it's not natural. I promise to you, I'm going to do my episode about jokes, and then I'll deal with all this kind of stuff in that one episode. All right. So anyway, I went to Indonesia with my wife, and I didn't cart her. We did go to Jakarta, but I didn't cart her there. No, we both went by plane. Fine. So we went straight on to Yogyakarta. The domestic flight was quite a different story to the international one. The international flights, Malaysian Airlines, despite their reputation at the moment, which is a little bit sketchy after the problems that Malaysia Airlines have had with one flight disappearing, another one being shot down in the sky over the Ukraine. It's tragic. But I have to say that when my girlfriend said, oh, by the way, we're flying Malaysian Airlines, I did think for a second, what, really? But it was, of course, it was absolutely fine. And in fact, the staff on the flight were great. They were really friendly and really helpful, like more friendly and helpful than cabin crew normally are. It was great, and they were very efficient, like perfectly on time, no complaints at all. The domestic flight, though, from Jakarta to Yogyakarta was a slightly different story, and we ended up sitting on the runway in the plane for like an hour. The plane wasn't air conditioned. We were completely smashed after flying for such a long time, and we were just sat there, just sort of like cooking inside the plane, wondering why the plane was delayed. Turns out a couple of passengers were late, and that's right, the plane just sat on the runway, just waiting for the passengers. Normally, if you're late, they just take off without you, but no, not here. They're flexible, they'll just wait for you, which I suppose is good if you're running late. If you're having a problem, for example, there's a road closure or something has gone wrong on the road, like a truck has broken down and blocked the road, you don't need to worry too much about missing your flight, because you'll know that the plane is just going to wait there on the runway. Everyone on that plane is just going to have to accept that that's the way it is. So it's less stress if you're late, but it's not if you are in a hurry to leave. We arrived at the airport. Of course, we were immediately surrounded by people all trying to get us into their taxi. It was really a group of people following us around, crowding around us. Taxi, taxi, taxi. You know, and it was quite overwhelming, a little bit difficult to know who to trust. In the end, we managed to get a metered taxi to take us to the hotel. And we, you know, looked out of the windows in our jet-lagged condition, sort of peered out of the windows at our first sights of Indonesia. And what we saw was scooter-filled streets, houses, warungs. A warung is like a little street-side restaurant. It's very basic. Normally, they have a grill on the street there, and they cook sort of chicken and rice and noodles and things, some little plastic tables around it, very, very simple sort of pop-up little restaurants. So lots of these places by the side of the road with all the locals sitting around eating, government buildings, all kinds of shops and market stalls and garages and all sorts of other buildings by the side of these dusty roads as we drove past them all. The driving there is a little bit stressful in terms of the way it's different. It seems that it's very common to beep your horn if you're driving. The horn beep, that basically means I'm here. And it's kind of a warning, as if to say, I'm going to overtake you, so watch out, you know, move out of the way. Beep, beep, or beep, beep, I'm turning a blind corner on the wrong side of the road, so please watch out if you're coming in the other direction. Beep, beep, you know, that kind of thing. Beep, beep, please be aware that we could have a head-on collision, which could, result in everyone in these cars being instantly killed. That's how it felt. Lots of sort of examples of overtaking on blind corners, driving on the wrong side of the road, quite frightening. But after a while, you kind of let it all wash over you. Lush green rice fields out the windows, coconut trees, more scooters, colourful flags by the side of the road. Like you get these long flags with different coloured these long poles with different coloured flags flying off them. I don't know what they represented, but they looked nice. The friendly taxi driver who had limited English. We arrived at our hotel, which was called the De Omar the De Omar Hotel, and what a fantastic place it is. It's in a town called Tembe, outside Yogyakarta, and it's owned by an Australian man called Warwick Purser. Quite an interesting story. He obviously loves Indonesia. He's decided to build a few hotels. He's got a De Omar Hotel in Indonesia. He's got another one on Bali. And what he does is he kind of works very closely with the local people in the village where he's built his hotel. He employs people from the village. He works very closely with the local community. And it shows. There's a really great atmosphere in this place. And you get a sense that it's like a really central part of village life. A lot of people who live in the village either work with the hotel or they work for the hotel in some way. Tembe was a lovely, quiet town with very friendly people, just rice paddy fields, just loads of wild chickens roaming around, children playing in the street, really nice place. The hotel, De Omar Hotel, was actually nearly destroyed by an earthquake a few years ago. We read some things about it. The whole thing was nearly smashed to pieces and they had to rebuild it. So it seems it's a kind of a labour of love for Warwick Purser, the Australian owner of the place. The staff there were unbelievably lovely and friendly, just really kind and really sweet, always welcoming you with a smile. It was really a first-class experience. And that's really thanks to my girlfriend, who's very good at finding these places. She decided that we would pay a little bit more than normal. I mean, it was still very good price. If we'd stayed in a place like that here in Europe, we would have paid through the nose for it. But there it was quite a reasonable price, really. We paid a little bit more than the market prices there, but we wanted a nice place to start with after our long flight. We wanted to arrive in a nice place, and it was worth it. The hotel is kind of like a series of little bungalows, let's say, or little rooms connected together, and it's designed really nicely of the old dark wood that they have there, and there are these kind of Japanese style ponds dotted around between the rooms. So these ponds full of carp, fish, and lilies floating on the ponds. So it's got this atmosphere of like you're surrounded by running water, you're surrounded by pond life, fish, and so on. We were shown into our room. We had a large four-poster bed, you know, a bed with a frame around it, with a mosquito net going all around the bed. Huge bed, really nice and comfortable, luxury. Chairs, desk, a day bed, which is like another bed there in the room, but it's sort of open and you can just spend time relaxing on there during the day. Obviously, we had our own bathroom and stuff. Open a couple of doors in one wall and you open out onto a swimming pool, a shared swimming pool. Very tastefully done. Sort of stone, and the water looks like it's just natural spring water. Little wooden shelter at the end of the pool. Really, really nicely done. Open out another pair of doors on the other side of the room. You've got your own little private pond with a little fountain with running water, fish, frogs in the pond and everything. A couple of nice chairs where you can sit and relax and have a drink and just enjoy the atmosphere. Next to our bathroom, there was a kind of blind, you know, a blind that covers a window. Normally a blind covers like a window or a pair of glass doors or something. In this case, you pull up the blind, just immediately there's a pond. So a little step down and a pond. So it's just like kind of like living with water around us, incredible atmosphere, beautiful place, lovely environment to be. On our first evening, my girlfriend was having a shower. I heard a little scream come from the shower, nothing too hysterical, just a whoo kind of thing. Turns out there was a crab in the shower. You know, a crab, they walk around sideways, normally in the sea. They've got like powerful claws, a crab. Yeah. Well, there was a crab in the shower. Turns out a crab had somehow managed to crawl out of the pond next to the bathroom, and it made his way into the shower. A little black freshwater crab. I had to dispose of him and throw him back into the pond. That was an interesting moment. It felt like we were surrounded by nature. Lizards on the walls and things like that. It was actually very atmospheric and nice. On the first night, we were treated to a sort of traditional dinner called a ristafel, which I believe is a Dutch thing, because Indonesia, of course, at one point was a Dutch colony from the Netherlands, you know. Back in the day, they'd colonized that part of the world, and they introduced some aspects of their culture there. And a ristafel is basically like a selection of plates of different meat and different foods and things. And so we enjoyed sitting down outside the hotel in the restaurant area, which is like a little veranda onto the street with a view of the rice field. And like there are ducks and geese walking around and things. And then sitting there on the wall in front of us was a group of local musicians playing some really sweet and charming local music. And then just down the street, carrying candles and plates of food, members of staff from the hotel walked through into the hotel and started serving us food. It was incredibly atmospheric and a lovely introduction to our first night there. So yes, the musicians, it was a beautiful kind of music they were playing, very charming and sweet. They were playing a combination of instruments, sort of ukuleles, it looked like, guitars, a cello. Someone was playing a cello like a bass, like a double bass, but it was a cello, a violin, some traditional wire percussion instruments and drums. It was absolutely lovely. Obviously, I ordered some of the local beer, and the beer there is called Bintang, and it's very nice. It's a kind of a dry lager, we would call it. Really nice beer, Bintang. I recommend it. If you get the chance to drink some Bintang, do it. It's good stuff. Obviously, the foods are the traditional stuff like chicken satay, lots of lemongrass and cashew nut and chili and garlic and stuff. Tasty. So Yogyakarta is probably Java's cultural capital. It's not the administrative capital of the island, but it is the cultural capital. And it has a sheikh's palace. There is a sheikh in Yogyakarta, like a sort of prince, an emperor, that kind of thing. They call him the sheikh. He has a palace there, and also another place called the Water Castle. And we visited both of them on our second day. The palace is where the sheikh lives, and you can visit his palace in the mornings, and in the afternoons it's closed, and that's when he kind of like, you know, chills out there. The palace is a nice place to visit. You can walk around and see some sort of displays of the artwork that he has. There are portraits of previous sheikhs that have lived there, and you get to see some like nice beautiful fabrics, paintings of the sheikhs, as I said, bits of treasure and so on. When we went, there were gangs of local school kids who were visiting the palace for a school trip, and they'd obviously been told by their teachers that they had to try and interview any English speakers that they met. So we got regularly kind of kidnapped by these groups of kids who would interview us, you know, asking what our names were and where we were from and talking to us. We were actually really pleasantly surprised that some of them were very good at English, and they were very communicative, and they were willing to talk, and they even wanted our email addresses. I don't know why. I think maybe as some kind of evidence that they'd actually talked to us, so they could show their teachers. Naturally, I gave them the website address for teacherluke.co.uk. So who knows? Maybe there are some young Indonesian kids listening to this right now. I wonder if they have actually tuned in. Anyway, what else? We also visited Taman Sari, which is the water castle, which was built at the end of the 18th century. And this was a place where the sheikh would spend time with his concubines. Concubines, of course, are basically like his mistresses, his girlfriends. He was married, and he was married to more than one woman, but he also had, I don't know if the sheikh still has concubines, but anyway, back in the day, he had lots of these other women who would entertain him. These often were women that he'd kind of kidnapped, because he would kind of like go to different areas and he would, let's see, wait a minute. Yeah, so these are he would conquer different places, and when after conquering them, obviously he would then take a selection of some of the women from those places, kidnap them, maybe. And so these concubines were then kept at the water castle, although they lived nearby, and he would meet them here at the water castle. There are kind of pools of water, sort of like large swimming pools, very luxurious. And that's where the concubines would wait, and they would sort of hang around in the water. And the sultan, the sheikh, sultan, that's the right word, the sultan would sit in a tower and sort of watch them and then pick one or two to then spend time with him. And he'd probably then, you know, have sex with them, I suppose. And now I viewing the water castle and just being able to picture it, I wondered how that must have felt for these women. How must they have felt? Either they would have been horrified, you know, because they'd basically been kidnapped and taken against their will. So they may have been horrified, like it's some kind of horrendous nightmare being forced to you know, sleep with this guy. Either they would have been horrified, or it's quite possible that some of them may have actually been honoured, because in a way that this was an honour for them, and it could mean a slightly better life. And even the children of the sultan, born from his concubines, they had privileges and were considered slightly higher status people. So it must have been a weird, mixed up feeling, being kidnapped and taken and then being chosen by the sultan. Because on one hand you're thinking, no thanks, but on the other hand you might think, well, this is a chance to, you know, have a slightly better life. It's a weird time. Anyway, it's amazing that it all occurred right there and we were able to see it, including his massive bed. We even saw like his huge bed that he had, where I imagine he entertained more than one guest at a time. But I'm just imagining there, just speculating. We were shown around by a guy whose family had lived in the grounds of this castle for generations, and he worked as a kind of warden and tour guide for the castle. And he told us that the modern day sultan was actually in the process of selling that land to foreign investors, and that in fact it had been sold to Starbucks, and that they were going to develop the sort of building area around the castle. Imagine that. Imagine what the place might be like in a few years. It might be going to visit the water castle sponsored by Starbucks, and it'll be a combination of a heritage site and a Starbucks coffee restaurant. It's quite unbelievable, really. And I got the impression that the current sultan doesn't really care about his people that much, that he's more interested in making money. But what do I know? We had drinks in town that evening. It's quite hard to find places to have drinks. It was quite fun and yet slightly worrying to kind of ride around in a taxi, not quite knowing where you're going, searching for a place in the guidebook that doesn't actually exist anymore. But it was nice to kind of walk around the streets. It's a different atmosphere at night. We did manage to walk around Tembe, as I said. The place is full of nature. Frogs in the ponds all around the hotel. Birds and lizards in the ceiling at night. You hear kind of like sounds in the ceiling, and it's like, what is that? Probably just a bird or a lizard crawling around. The crab in the shower, of course. Ducks, geese and chicken roaming around the village everywhere. Children playing in the streets. The incredibly loud call to prayer from the mosque nearby at 4:30 in the morning that woke us up. But we didn't really mind. Borobudur is a Buddhist temple, which is about 1 hour from Yogyakarta. We went to visit that. It was built in the 9th century. The 9th century. That's a hell of a long time ago. Basically, it's kind of a Buddhist pilgrimage site these days, built, as I said, a long time ago. And it's made of 6 square platforms with 3 circular platforms on top. It's very big. It's at the top of a hill. It's a very impressive structure to see. And you kind of walk around each platform and look at the carved reliefs on each wall. So imagine sort of 6 square platforms getting smaller each time. And they're like, you walk around them, then you walk up a few steps and walk around the next one, which is a bit smaller, walk up a few more steps, walk around that. And on the walls of each platform, there are carvings in the stone. And the carvings are all sort of different stories of the Buddha's life. And they're all kind of stories that explain the Buddha's journey from birth all the way through to his eventual sort of status as an enlightened being, the first one to achieve nirvana. And there are also in these carvings kind of cautionary tales about how a life of pleasure can ultimately lead to a life of suffering. And the idea in the design of this place is that by walking up and looking at all of these carvings, you learn about the process of achieving nirvana or enlightenment. And as you get further and further up, the images that you see represent the stages of enlightenment until you get to the top, where you see a large statue of Buddha in a kind of state of nirvana. It's fascinating. There are over 2,500 relief carvings and 504 Buddha statues. Amazing place. Apparently, it was abandoned in the 14th century after the decline of the Hindu religion. Hinduism and Buddhism are sort of related. And often in these places, these temples are sort of a mix of Buddhism and Hindu religion. They kind of worked together to an extent. So after the decline of Hindu religion in the 14th century, the place apparently was abandoned. And then the introduction of Islam into Javanese culture may have led to the place being sort of ignored. It was discovered again in the early 19th century by a Dutch engineer called H.C. Cornelius, who was working for the then British ruler of Java, who was known as the Governor General, Sir Thomas Stamford Raffles. Sir Thomas Stamford Raffles was the British Governor General of Java at that point in the early 19th century. He sent the Dutch engineer H.C. Cornelius to go and find Borobudur Temple. It's like something out of a kind of Victorian adventure story, don't you think? Imagine H.C. Cornelius, he set out into the Javanese jungle with some guidelines from the locals, and they found it after slashing through the jungle and burning down the undergrowth in order to discover it. They found it, but it was overgrown, covered in earth, covered in volcanic dust. That's right, after various volcanoes and volcanic eruptions covered the thing in dust, it was almost underground, covered in dirt and mud and overgrown. Gradually, over the years, it was uncovered and restored. UNESCO did a huge restoration job on it in the 70s, almost taking the whole thing to pieces, cleaning it and putting it back together again. And now it's all cleaned up and it looks great. And it's back, it's restored to its status as a pilgrimage site. And it's also the number one tourist destination in the country. So it's a bit like a pyramid with three circular platforms on the top. And as you get further and further up, there are more and more statues of the Buddha, some of them sitting under these kind of bell-like structures. It's a fascinating and mysterious place. Plus, you get views of the local sort of land from the top of it. Really, really good. You can just Google pictures of Borobudur if you want to see what I'm talking about. We also visited another place called Prambanan, which is a Hindu temple similar to Angkor Wat in Cambodia. It's a large number of temples, very large sort of structures, like sort of diamond-shaped temples, all dedicated to different Hindu gods, and with all kinds of carvings on the walls of each temple again, and statues of the gods used to be contained within each temple, but they're not there anymore. Unfortunately, the statues have gone. In fact, almost the entire set of temples at Prambanan were knocked down. All of them were smashed to the pieces and knocked down to the ground by an earthquake. But they've been rebuilt again, and now you can see them restored, and it's very impressive. There are still many other structures nearby that are still basically rubble, like lots of rocks and rubble on the ground because they haven't been built again. It's a very impressive place. We spent a few hours there staying for the sunset, and then we went home. Other things that we could have done were a demonstration of a traditional Ramayana ballet dance telling the old Hindu story of King Rama. That's a popular thing for tourists to do. It's a sort of several hours in the evening you see this traditional Indonesian ballet dance that tells the story of a Hindu king. But we didn't see that. In the end, again, we couldn't do too much. We flew to Lombok. Lombok Island. We skipped Bali, as I said, and flew to Lombok. We stayed in a hotel in a place called Surabaya on the way there. And anyway, let me skip a little bit. So I can't go into all of this in too much detail. Lombok is the next island after Bali, and it's less touristy than Bali, but it's just as beautiful, with lush greenery, sandy beaches, friendly people, and a large volcano in the middle. We stayed in the resort area of Senjiji to get some beachside relaxation. It's a beautiful little peninsula there, and sandy beaches going all the way around, with coral reefs around them. Great for snorkeling. You can spend time on the beach reading. There was live music at the beach every evening at 6 p.m. While the sun went down, there was a band playing live music, playing stuff like Santana and classic bits of rock music. It was really nice to spend some time there, get a bit of sun, get a bit of relaxation done. Delicious food in the local warungs. We bought some handicraft in the local market, strolled around the beach at night, all that kind of stuff. It was lovely. We also planned our Mount Rinjani climb, and I'd like to tell you about that in a bit more detail now. Okay, so Mount Rinjani is the second largest volcano in Indonesia. But although it's not the largest, it's still pretty massive. It's nearly three times the height of the UK's highest mountain, which is Ben Nevis in Scotland. It's an active volcano. What a good idea, Luke. Yeah, hey, let's climb up an active volcano. What could go wrong? It's an active volcano. First of all, it rises up to about 2,500 meters above sea level. And there is a crater rim. A crater, you know, like a volcano, the sides go up and then there's a crater in the middle where all the fire comes out. Well, this one rises up about 2,500 meters, and then there's a large wide crater rim, which is about 7 kilometers wide. And in the middle of it, there's a large lake. It's beautiful. There's a lake there. And then in the middle of the lake, there's another smaller volcano where obviously other eruptions have happened more recently. So within the volcano, there's another small volcano. It's incredible. That little volcano last erupted in 2010, I believe. Then the absolute peak of the mountain is on one side of the crater, where it rises up to 3,726 meters above sea level. And if you can climb all the way to the top of that, you're given an incredible view of the surrounding area. You can see down into the crater with the lake and the mini volcano, and you can see out across Lombok, you can see out to the ocean, and you can see the other islands like Bali, and you can see mountains and volcanoes on the other islands in Indonesia. It's absolutely stunning, but it's incredibly challenging to climb up to the top. I'm going to try and tell you about it now. Okay, so we thought, since we're going to be going to Indonesia, we should do one mountain climb. We should do one volcano. Let's do Rinjani. My girlfriend read about it, and she read lots of accounts of how people had spent 3 days and two nights trekking up Rinjani. None of these accounts seem to quite explain just how difficult it is. I don't know why. Maybe people don't want to seem like they're weak or something. You know, everyone was writing, oh, it was fine, it wasn't too difficult. I don't know who these people are. Maybe they're expert climbers. But in my experience, and just looking at all the other people who climbed with us, it was very tough. We found it to be very tough. Everyone else around us seemed to be finding it to be extremely tough. Even the guides and porters admitted that it was really hard to climb up this mountain. We didn't realize that until later. But anyway, we're glad that we did it, but it was hard. 3 days, two nights. Oh my God. I've like during the experience, it felt like one of the toughest things that I've ever done. And it felt also like one of the most amazing things I've ever done. And I just couldn't wait to be able to tell everyone about it. It's so hard now after a week, after over a week of being back, and after over a week since I did it, it's hard really to capture the experience of it. But I'll try and do my best for you now, and I'll try and keep it brief. Okay, so imagine imagine you set out. What I'm trying to explain to you is not only the physical challenge of it, but the mental challenge too. Okay, the mental challenge. Now, you know, for example, when you have to, if you're walking up a hill, or if you're walking up the side of a mountain, or if you're walking up lots and lots of steps, you know how exhausting it is after, let's say, even just half an hour of walking up steps. That's pretty exhausting. Imagine doing it for 12 hours. Like, even after an hour, and you think, my God, I'm exhausted already. How much more of this is there? And the guide says, oh, about another 10 hours. Well, yeah, that's quite hard. So we started walking through farmland, carrying stuff on our backs. We had one guide. He was a lovely guy. He was amazing. His name was Pahi, and he was just the sweetest guy. For me, he looked a bit like a teddy bear. Seriously, he was kind of small. He was really, really cute-looking guy, really sweet. He was probably about 45 years old or something. He looked like a teddy bear. He looked like an Ewok from Return of the Jedi. I don't mean to make fun of him or anything, because I'm not. He was just brilliant. But he was our guide, and he carried a huge backpack on his back, carrying a lot of stuff for us, including lots of water. We asked him if we could carry stuff, and he said no. He refused to let us carry any of his things. And we thought, well, it is his job. He is a professional, after all. Also, we had a couple of porters who were incredible. The porters are just local guys who work on the mountain, and their job is to carry your stuff up the mountain, right? And how do they do it? Well, basically, they have one big piece of bamboo, one long pole of bamboo, and they hang baskets off each end of this bamboo. The bamboo is thick. It's probably about 15 centimeters thick. So these are big branches of bamboo with these big heavy baskets containing loads of bottles of water, cooking equipment, camping equipment, and stuff like that. And so they had to carry all this stuff up the mountain, and they're just there in shorts and t-shirts wearing flip-flops. They go up and down the mountain carrying these incredibly heavy loads, wearing flip-flops, sometimes in bare feet, and they're skipping up and down the mountain. They're incredible. It's unbelievable. Walking through farmland, you walk up then through the foothills and then up into the much more challenging, quite steep slopes of Mount Rinjani. It took us 7 days. 7 days? No, it took us 7 hours, the first part of the climb. And that's in the boiling hot heat with the sun bearing down, pouring sweat. The ground underneath our feet, a lot of it was just sort of dust or sand. It's very hard to climb on it. You climb up and you lose your footing. It's easy to slip. The dust is in the air. You get covered in dust. It mixes in with your sweat, and you end up with crap all over your legs. I mean, I was covered in mud basically for 3 days. I had it in my ears, my eyes, up my nose. I had it in my mouth, smeared all over my legs. We didn't really have a chance to have a shower at any time. I know I'm making it sound like it was horrible, and in a way it was horrible, but you kind of go through all the horrible stuff in order to get the ultimate achievement, which is to get to the top. 7 hours of climbing, completely exhausted, we got to the top of the crater rim. That's where we camped that night, saw an incredible sunset that evening. We got up at 2 a.m., 2 o'clock in the morning. So that's basically, we went to bed at 7, tried to sleep, feeling a bit nervous about the climb the next day, up at 2 a.m. in order to climb the very challenging slope to the summit, and that is about 3 or 4 hours of climbing in the middle of the night. And that was really the toughest part, not just that it was in the middle of the night, but just the gradient of the climb was really, really steep. The ground underneath our feet was like very uneven sand and pebbles, volcanic dust basically is what you're walking through. And it was like you kind of, every step is an incredible effort. And you step up a few steps and slide back down. Sometimes you slip and fall. There were times where I felt like we were walking on the moon. I mean, it was dark and there were incredible stars in the sky above us. We were way up above the clouds. The air up there is very thin. There's not much oxygen. And after a while, you get to this incredibly steep section where you're every step is a huge effort. And I was scared, you know, I was genuinely scared that we wouldn't make it. I thought that I was wondering if my girlfriend would make it. She doesn't have much climbing experience. I've got a bit, but we're not advanced climbers by any means. And it was a real, real challenge. And it was really just a case of like battling against the mountain, one step at a time. You know, if you think about how much further you've got to go when you realize that you're absolutely exhausted, then mentally you will be defeated and you can't do it. You really have to try to stay positive and try to realize that you're just going one step at a time. Don't try and think about the entire challenge because it will be too much. There were moments of drama up there. For example, at about 4:30 a.m. when we were really high, maybe about 3,500 meters above sea level, there's a cold wind blowing past and a very narrow track with very sharp drops on either side. And you think, oh my God, you know, I could slip and fall at any moment. It was freezing cold. My girlfriend was shivering. She was like shivering. Her jaw was chattering. And I was like worried, you know, trying to keep her warm, trying to rub her hands, trying to help her up the mountain. There was a moment where I tried to get something out of her backpack, standing on the side with this freezing wind blowing through in this kind of dark wasteland at the, you know, in the sky, it felt like, with just the stars above us. I was trying to get something out of her bag, but my hands were so frozen that I could hardly control the zip. And that at that moment, her zip on her bag decided to break. And the whole zip came out. I was trying to fix it, and the zip came off in my hand. It was like a sort of moment of drama. Now, you might think, oh, that's no big deal. But in that situation, it feels like a huge drama, because if her bag is open, all of her stuff's going to go flying out. And also, we're going to need to carry all that stuff back down the other side of the mountain the next couple of days. So I was trying to like transfer all the stuff from her bag to my bag. Things were flying away in the wind. Her iPhone headphones just flew off. And flew out into the middle of the air, lost. And she was like shivering at this point. I was thinking, oh my God, we've got to keep moving, we've got to keep moving. Because there, as I said, there's no mountain rescue there, no helicopters on the island at all, nothing. If you can't make it, the only thing you can do is just walk down. So it's pretty precarious. Yeah, really stunning experience. I'm really not getting through to you the challenge. You're just going to have to take my word for it. But ultimately, we got to the top. There was a moment where I slipped and I hit my leg on the ground. I hit my leg on a stone and my whole leg went dead. Just searing pain went through my leg. The whole thing just went dead. And I was like limping, screaming, limping up the mountain. It was like World War II or something. I mean, it really was. It felt like we were I can't really get through to you at this point how I wish I could. I wish I just was able to describe in much more emotive terms what it was like. But I think you're getting the idea, right? It was challenging. It was the most difficult thing that we've ever done. And finally getting to the top, which we did manage to do, as the sun broke up from the horizon, was really quite an emotional experience, actually, because I felt proud. You know, I felt proud of her for making it and for having the mental resolve to get up to the top when I was concerned that she wasn't going to make it. I was proud of us both. It was a stunning experience. And incredible, really. I wouldn't do it again. No thanks. No way. But I'm very glad that we did do it. And we took photos up there, and it's something that we'll remember for the rest of our lives. Then, of course, we had to get back down again. And that was really only the beginning. The idea was 7 hours to the crater summit, 4 hours up to the top, sunrise, 3 hours back down. Then you get a little break, half an hour. Then it's another 3 hours climbing down rocks. 3 hours of climbing down rocks until you get to the lake, where you get a chance to relax and bathe in the hot springs. Then another 3 or 4 hours of going up the other side of the crater. You camp there, and then you spend 8 hours walking down the mountain on the other side. Now, when you realize that you've got to the top of the mountain and you're finished, you know, you're physically knackered, it's quite overwhelming when you realize how far you've got to go after that. So we managed to get back down to the bottom completely exhausted. I mean, it's surprising what your body can do if you ask it to. The body is the body will go quite far. It's amazing, yeah, what you're capable of. If mentally you're prepared to keep going, the body does go along with you. But we got down to the other side and had a little bite to eat and set off with about 20 minutes left. And it was quite clear that my girlfriend was not well, which is not uncommon when you're going traveling to places like this. It had happened to me several years ago in Laos. I picked up some kind of bacteria, and it basically took me out of my life for 12 hours. I spent one night every half an hour getting up to go to the toilet. I couldn't even drink water. I couldn't keep water down. If you can't keep something down, that means you eat it and it immediately comes back. I couldn't even keep my water down. I was taking mouthfuls of water. That was coming straight back up. Hell. I mean, hell, for 12 hours, all of the liquid was ejected from my body and I felt like I was going to die. That's normal. That's how you feel when you get that kind of condition. The worst thing about it was that the next day I had to get on a bus for 7 hours, and the bus was driving around these corners through the hills, and I was sitting on there just feeling like I was going to die, and I couldn't, you know, all I had was half a small bottle of water. The only thing I could listen to on my Walkman was a solo album by Sting. That's how bad it was, ladies and gentlemen. The only thing that I could stand to listen to was a solo album by Sting. Yes, I couldn't even listen to hardcore music. All I could listen to was sort of insipid, middle-of-the-road, easy-listening music. That's how bad it was. Now, I felt like that was pretty awful, and I didn't eat for 32 hours, and I lost a lot of body weight and all that kind of thing. It's normal, it happens, but it felt pretty awful. Now imagine that on the side of a mountain. Unbelievable. And so we decided that we would, instead of going down to the lake and back up the other side and so on, we would return the way we came. Still 7 hours of walking down a hill, you know, in stones and mud and dust and everything. And so the next day we started and... yeah, she was not well, taking tiny little steps. I don't know if you've ever felt like that. When you're in that condition, just walking to the bathroom is enough of a challenge. But walking down the side of a mountain in the middle of the day, yeah, I think you get the idea. She was taking these little steps. She was unsure on her feet. Every now and then she slipped. She even cut her hand open on a rock. The porter and me were looking after her. I was trying to encourage her, keep her positive and everything. But I honestly was worried, especially at one point after about 5 hours when she hadn't eaten and she could hardly drink. We got to a rest point and I thought she was going to pass out. She nearly did pass out in my arms. I was holding her up. You know, she had to lie down. I was staring at her as she was lying there, staring at her, trying to make sure that she was still breathing. I mean, I was panicking. I don't know what would happen, but I just felt like she was going to collapse from dehydration or exhaustion or something. I was checking her pulse and everything. It was really, really worrying. The things that saved her were three things. One was a little lie down. Lying down and sleeping for about half an hour did her the world of good. The second thing was a drink, a Japanese drink called Pocari Sweat. Pocari Sweat is a kind of energy drink, a sports drink, which is specifically designed to help your body replenish lost fluid and lost body salts. And it was exactly what she needed. Pocari Sweat is a strange drink. If you're in Japan, you'll know what I'm talking about. If you're not in Japan, yes, it is called Pocari Sweat. Sweat, like the stuff that comes out of your head when you're hot, the liquid that drips down your forehead. Sweat, yes. Pocari Sweat. Now, it even looks like sweat. It's kind of like a pale sort of liquid. It looks like a salty water or something. It looks, doesn't look very appetizing. Tastes a bit lemony. It's quite nice. But it does look like sweat. And you think, is this sweat? Is this like the, is this actually the sweat of a Pocari that I'm drinking? What is a Pocari? I don't even know. I mean, are they sort of like these creatures that they hang up in some hot room and they catch all the sweat from Pocaris and it goes into a bottle and then we drink Pocari Sweat and it helps us to climb mountains? I don't know what this stuff is, but it really, really worked. And it really gave her a lot of, it replaced a lot of her lost fluids and sugar and salt and stuff like that and put her back on her feet. And the third thing that kept her going was the prospect of a clean shower and a bed. Honestly, that was really like the light at the end of the tunnel for her. Like, I just want to get to this bed on this island at the end of this trip. And that's what kept her going. And in fact, by the time we got down the worst part of the hills, she was actually impressively full of energy. And the Pocari Sweat had replaced her fluids. And she was full of energy. And she was suddenly motoring, marching down the foothills of this mountain. It was really touch and go for a moment, but ultimately she pulled through. And thankfully, I mean, she always talks about going on a diet and losing weight. Well, this is the ideal way to lose weight. Just climb a mountain for 30 hours. I think that's a great way of losing weight. I don't recommend it, but it definitely works. Anyway, she's absolutely fine now. And of course, we're both super glad and happy to have managed to make it down, up and down that mountain in one piece. Now, if you listen to part one of this episode, there was an introduction to this account of my holiday in which you found me on a boat facing rather a terrible situation. Well, after having done the mountain and feeling like we'd been taken apart by God and put back together again, new, and yet completely exhausted and sort of spiritually bereft and all that kind of thing, we took a truck journey down to the port, trying not to pass out on the back of this truck for about 3 hours, and we finally arrived in the port completely smashed, ready to just collapse right there and then. But we had to take this boat, and we did manage to get on the boat, and it was completely crowded, and it was quite frightening because the boat was very low in the water and there were loads of people on the boat. Even the locals seemed to be stressed out, as if this was dangerous, as if this was the one, this was the one boat that would crash and change things. And it was true that 3 days earlier, a very similar boat had capsized in the water near the island of Komodo and had drowned many of its passengers. So we were understandably very worried. And that's quite normal sort of experience to be in a place like this, in these situations. It's incredibly exciting and adventurous, but it is quite frightening because you think to yourself, there's no safety regulation. We might not make it to the other end. Well, you'll be glad to know that, in fact, the boat didn't capsize. We didn't get thrown into the water. That was just my fear. That's just what I was scared of. When I closed my eyes, that's what I imagined could happen. But thankfully, it didn't happen. Okay. I count the story that I said, that I told you at the beginning of part one, that was just a kind of imagined version of what could easily have happened, but which didn't happen. And we did get to the other side, and we did spend 3 days on this beautiful little island called Gili Air, which is an incredible place. The locals are friendly, amazing white sandy coral beaches with great snorkeling. I spent time snorkeling around. Snorkeling, you know, that's when you swim with flippers on. You swim with a mask and a snorkel, which is a tube that comes out of your mouth and allows you to breathe while looking at all the fish and stuff. I saw lots of gorgeous fish, tropical fish and things like that. What did I see? Parrot fish. It's a fish that looks like a parrot. Not a dead parrot, in this case a living parrot, beautiful green colour with like a little beak and everything. I saw a puffer fish, you know those fish that puff up with spikes? I saw one of them swimming around, I followed that around. I saw barracuda swimming around in the water and I thought, barracuda, don't they bite? They were fine though. Unfortunately, I didn't see any turtles. I really wanted to see turtles. And I didn't go diving. I know that that island is famous for its diving, where you can go deep sea diving. I'd never done it before, and we just never really got round to it. We just were quite happy walking around, glad to be alive, enjoying our time there. So all in all, it was a really great time. We didn't capsize in the middle of the sea. The boat arrived safely. As I said before in this episode, traveling is an amazing experience, but at times it can feel a little bit scary. I just wanted to express the adrenaline rush and the fear factor that you can experience in these situations. On that boat ride and during the Rinjani trek, I really was trying not to panic sometimes. I was trying not to get freaked out by what could have happened. You might be thinking, Luke, you worry too much, or something like that. But I think, actually, I'm just being realistic. We do have these moments of fear, and that's what really makes it exciting. Sometimes you have to get a little close to the edge in order to really experience real life. When everything's so safe, it can get a little bit boring, can't it? And that's right, it is character-building stuff. Okay, and I think that brings me to the end of this account of my time in Indonesia. I do hope that you've listened all the way to the end. If you're still with me, then well done. You're an extra special, super brilliant turbo listener from the future. I'll be talking to you again very soon. And before long, you'll be able to hear competition entries, which I've had from listeners to the podcast. It's great to be back, ladies and gents. And thank you for listening all the way to the end of this episode of the podcast. I'll speak to you again very soon. Please do leave your comments, thoughts, suggestions, ideas, questions, criticism, hate mail, love mail, whatever it is that you want to say. Please do leave your comments at teacherluke.co.uk. But for now, from me, it's goodbye. Bye, bye, bye. Thanks for listening to Luke's English podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.